So one way to build self-esteem is to appreciate the feedback, even if it's not what you want to hear. It's not all feedback is good. Some no's are not, they're off base. Some no's are off base. But if you just continually look at your work and no matter what the field is, then those no's can actually be very helpful for you to move forward and to grow.
Okay, so tonight I am here with Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn is the, I'm assuming, producer, but she runs Good is in the Details podcast. And we are here to talk all about self-esteem for women and imposter syndrome. Gwendolyn holds a PhD in philosophy, so there's really nobody better than to dive into a lot of the parts of this topic that we're going to talk to you. Thank you for being here, Gwendolyn.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's go ahead and start with talking about your podcast and its mission. Good is in the details. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I co-host it with Rudy Salo. He is a lawyer and I'm a philosophy professor, and we thought that we would team up. We actually knew each other in high school, and then after high school went our different ways, and then it was just a few years we reconnected, and I saw that he likes to do voice acting, and he had done a couple of podcasts, and so I pitched him on this idea of Good is in the Details, and he was on board, and it's been a wonderful 5 year, almost 5 year journey
No.
since. And the origin behind it is that in my work in philosophy, I often have students who will keep in touch or they'll ask me questions after class that have to do with the material. And they are not philosophy majors, but they thought these questions about, wait, do I have free will or am I determined? Or questions about sexuality. One of the classes I teach is philosophy of sex and love, about the dating world, and does God exist? All of these questions that are philosophical questions, they genuinely seem to enjoy talking about them. And I thought, I don't want to gatekeep this university experience. What if we were to take what is going on in the classroom in a university experience and make it for a broad public? And so that was the idea behind it. I didn't know how it would work. Speaking about imposter syndrome, it was very scary because when I'm in the university setting, I am in charge, right? And I've got an audience of young people in front of me, or when I go to an academic conference, we're all in the same business. So then to say, hey, I'm going to try to do this to the public, just go ahead and explore these ideas, was really frightening for me and made me wonder, wait, am I good enough to do this? And fortunately, I want to say having a really great podcast partner is absolutely key, and having a good network of friends who are supportive and honest, then that's really helpful.
That's so awesome. And I could imagine there might also be some fear around how these topics will be received with the general public and how your ratings are and like reviews. Have you had really good feedback and it's been similar to the university experience, proving your hypothesis?
Yeah, it has been. It really has. I have to say, I feel really lucky, but I know that when you can, I've tried to encourage other academics to actually do this because it's really great for students. And what I mean by that is that in the podcast, I get to be a student again. So even though I have a lot of training and I've read a lot, and Rudy is super smart, he's UCLA grad, Georgetown Law. We both read all the time, but we enjoy inviting people over and or onto the podcast and say, hey, like, we don't know anything about what you know everything about. Teach us. And I think that spirit of curiosity, that spirit of continually learning from others and dialoguing and learning more about yourself in that process, that is what I wanted to share also for my students, so that they know that it's not just about memorizing things for an exam, but that there's a real joy in pursuing these intellectual and pursuing intellectual growth. And so that's part of our mission, and then that's part of the way that we operate. And I think that when you are really interested in something, you'll find your people. So I think one of the things in starting out, I was, of course, worried, is anybody going to listen to this? How do I not be offensive? Or you're just worried about so many things. And then I learned, wait a minute, I just have to go with my gut because the people who like what I like will come to the podcast. But if you're trying to appeal to everybody, you're going to appeal to nobody.
Yeah, you have to find your niche and you found it. And speaking of niche, this podcast is very oriented towards those people who are trying out careers that they didn't think that they ever could try, they didn't think they were qualified for, and those people that are trying sports, specifically endurance sports, long distance running, mountain hiking, mountaineering, and they never were active or they didn't ever think that they could. And demographically, there's a lot of females that listen to this podcast. So, from your lens of philosophy and your experience in that kind of looking at the world through that logic, I'm really excited to get into the self-esteem and imposter syndrome, and specifically self-esteem we can focus on right now in women and low self-esteem in women. I would assume is lower in women than men, but what are your experiences?
Yeah, it is lower in women. And I think that's cultural. I don't think that there's anything biological about that. But from when we're children, from when we're born, there's this idea of being precious, don't move. Like, I know I have a 4-year-old and she likes to run around and move, and we give her clothes appropriate for movement. But for a long time, the clothing that was given to little girls and little toddlers is all like the frilly dresses and everything. Whereas for boys, they have movement. And so when boys are running around and getting dirty, that's accepted as opposed to young girls. It's no, stop. So young women, and then are always trained to take up little space. Like when you even think about what are manners, and I'm not anti being polite, so I want to be very clear, but what is considered to be appropriate for a woman versus a man? And so men are taught with their body language to take up a lot of space, and women are taught with their body language to take up little space, to not speak out of turn. And so it takes a little bit more to get over that cultural hurdle to be comfortable with your voice, because if you're from you're very young, you're told that you're not supposed to have one, or as in terms of sports, you're not supposed to be like mobile and all over the place, then you just have more of a hurdle. On the other side of this is what makes women really incredible and really strong, is because they have that hurdle that when they are in charge of things, they are in charge. They think of everything, they think of all the angles. It's harder to knock them down because they've already knocked themselves down. So when they are in positions where they have worked really hard, they've had to excel in ways that are really unique. And this, I want to make sure that I'm cautious here, because I can speak in terms of my experience, but I know that from what I've read and also interacting with my students and my friends, but women of color, that there is another existential hurdle for them. And one of the problems that has existed historically is that when white women have been fighting for rights, that they left out women of color in that picture. And so there was another existential hurdle for a lot of American women. And again, because of that existential hurdle, they really are phenomenal when they get on the other side of that. But I think that there's a lot of work to chip away at presuppositions of a woman just based on the body into which she's born, of what she's capable of. And we haven't totally moved past that. We still have a tendency to look at a person and determine what it is that they're capable of. I can't tell you how many times in my career that I have been told, you don't look like a professor, or, oh, philosophy, whoa, that's a really, you have a PhD. And I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to look like, but it's a mental task. It's not a physical task. So there's no physical requirement to studying philosophy, other than drinking a lot of caffeine, I guess. That's about it. But I think that when it comes to self-esteem, we need to be aware of the cultural hurdles. I know that I'm in a different one right now, because now I am 46 and I'm going on 47. And there is a lot of marketing that's pushed to try to chip away at my self-esteem to suggest that if I'm past a certain age, then I am undesirable or simply not of value anymore. And a lot of makeup or creams and all of that is marketed to defy your age. So I'm continually supposed to look like I'm in my 20s. And I flip that and I say, hey, look, invite it. Invite your age. I don't even want to talk about accepting it. I don't even want to talk about defying it. accept your age. I refuse to go with it. I should feel bad or sheepish about the crow's feet around my eyes, about the fact that maybe I'm a little bit less mobile. But I have gained so much love and experience in the last couple decades of my life that right now in my 40s, I am absolutely enjoying everything about it. And it just would not be the same if I were to somehow erase that. And so I think that the self-esteem, we have to pay attention to where, what is the source? Is the world telling me that I'm supposed to be other than what I am? And we have to take the time to block out the noise from that kind of information. But that's really a task because when you're in that bubble, it's hard to know that you're in that bubble.
Very true, and very great segue into talking about very specific scenarios that low self-esteem can surface for women. It, as you were saying, it permeates through everywhere, and you really can't get away from it in terms of like when you're growing up, and then you're in your career, and then you're in school or school, and then career. But it rears its ugly head so many places, and it's quite annoying. But if there's any tips that we can have in our back pocket to get through these times, and I had listed four different categories and would love to get your thoughts on these four areas that I'm hopeful many people experience at least one of these so they can latch on. But difficulty accepting compliments, that's very hard. No, like it was this other person. Like I wouldn't have been here without this other person, or it was luck.
Women have a tendency to do that. They credit their success to a lot of external factors. Men don't do that as much. There's an in-between, though. Like when somebody's trying to take all the credit for their success, that's not entirely true. We have to be honest about circumstances and opportunity. And at the same time, women need to be honest that it wasn't just circumstance and opportunity, that they were the ones who were bringing something to the table. So it's somewhere in all of that. But accepting a compliment, yeah, it's difficult. I have trouble with it. It's not an easy thing, and I am not entirely sure why. It takes some time to learn to be gracious with it, but I think that women spend so much time being concerned with others that they don't know what to do with the information if they are all of a sudden in the spotlight and accept that compliment. And then they also have to walk that very fine balance of when they do accept the compliment to not come across as full of themselves, because that's also something you're not supposed to do. So I think that one of the things that we need to do is be honest about what success is, that it is layers of work, of course, that the individual works on their talent, right? The individual puts in that work, that mindset, and it is also circumstance and opportunity. When those things come together, your talent, your work, and circumstance and opportunity.
I love that. And it could even be in that conversation calling out those specific pieces, right? Like, yeah, I worked really hard on this one piece. And then I passed it over to Kathy and she gave it a once over and we determined it was good to go. Like very much so own where it's helpful, where you had the help, where you took it and completely ran with it. That's actually really good advice. Like own both pieces.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So how about lack of boundaries, which could mean so many physical, emotional.
Yes. Lack of boundaries. It's also hard for women to say no
Oh, yeah.
and to say, I'm going to take this time for myself.
No is a full
And
sentence.
yes, and the reason why is again, it's training that you're always supposed to be considerate of other people. Everybody else comes first. And so working on those boundaries requires some reflection, some basic understanding of human needs. So what do we need to flourish as human beings? Treat yourself as a human being instead of a woman. And then you'll start to pay attention that as a living, breathing human being, what is it that we need? We do need affection and social relationships. We need to move. So go for a walk. We need to be intellectually stimulated. And so go ahead and listen to a great podcast, read a good book. I don't care if it's smut, go for it. Those things require time or how some people relax by cooking. Like one of my good friends, she is an awesome cook. And when she goes to the grocery store, this is her time. And she loves to see all, she's so creative. She loves to see all of the possibilities. And then that's what she puts together. And she'll listen to music or to a podcast. And that is part of her time. That's not her, only her time. She also gets away with girlfriends. But stop thinking of yourself as a woman and start thinking of yourself as a human being with these basic needs for flourishing. And then when you're able to isolate those things, then tend to them. You know, you need that walk to clear your head and your thoughts. You're going a little bit crazy. You need that walk. You know that you need to have that extra water. You need a hug from your friend more than a text. You need to make the plans and go out and see that friend. You can both look like completely ragged. It doesn't matter because you're friends, and show up and give each other the hug that you need. And maybe it's just a 20-minute date, but you need that. These are the things that we need so that then we can return to our families, our careers as full human beings and present. It is so difficult now in the world of technology, apps, social media to actually turn it off and to tend to what you need as a human being. But whenever you turn that stuff off, then you are able to return to your family, show up for other people, but you first have to show up for yourself.
You do. Your boundaries make you much more present. That's a great way to,
Yeah, and it's dangerous. Also, I will say there is a danger. So one of the classes that I teach is Current Debates in Sexuality. It used to be called Philosophy of Sex and Love. I still call it Philosophy of Sex and Love, but we do talk about things like dating and the pressure that young women have if a man pays for the date or what are the expectations. And it's such a shame that all of that mental load is going in to go and meet a person. And not only that, but just before the date, all of the mental load of letting your friends know who you're going to see, where you're going to be, check in afterwards, and then go to the date and then hope that everything is safe. And so when we are putting other people before us, it is also a safety issue when it comes to boundaries. It's not only about self-care, it's about when something doesn't feel right, you don't have to worry about the other person's feelings. It's just not that important. Your safety is more important.
Perfect. That's really important to touch on for sure for that. And leading into hypersensitivity to criticism, you could get criticized for having your boundaries, even.
Yes,
Right?
that's true. I would just take the hit. I would just take the hit. It's taken me a long time to be able to say no. I do have a tendency to overbook myself. So it's so funny answering these questions because I want to be totally transparent and say that I'm not on a soapbox here. I'm in it too. Like I am in the social media funk. I have to turn it in airplane mode and put my phone in a different room and open up a physical book. I love mysteries. Get a good mystery that I'm going to get sucked into and just say, no more. Like my daughter's in bed. The phone is away. The laptop is closed. I am just going to read because I love mystery books and I feel so refreshed. The nights that I'm not disciplined and do that and I stay up scrolling, I do not wake up the next day refreshed and ready to work. There really is a difference. And so when it comes to criticisms, we worry so much about what other people think. And again, I'm not outside of this, but so much is put on women on how they present themselves. They have to have the right look. Now, I don't want for any, if any men are listening to this thing about dudes have issues too. That's totally true. There is a difference though, and I can just use this as an example. Turn on any news channel. The male anchor is not nearly as handsome, as beautiful as the woman is, or as young. That is a very big difference that the way in which the news is presented, that it's like we can only take the news if it's from a beautiful woman and a very average looking dude. It's just not as important. I know in the university setting that the men, the male professors, they dress how they want, really. Some wear a bow tie and some are in a t-shirt and jeans. I do not have that luxury. I cannot show up to the classroom in that same way. And that is just the social reality. If I were to show up without any makeup and in a t-shirt and ripped jeans, people would wonder what was wrong with me, or did I just let myself go? Is she okay if I were to just dress like one of my male colleagues? Not all male colleagues do that, but they can get away with it. So when it comes to criticism, I think the reason why women are so sensitive to it is because we're bombarded with it, that you always have to look right, have to look right. And there's no real metric. You're just not allowed to show up as is. But there are more women who are rejecting that. When they are rejecting that, there has been a social cost, but then there's also been a lot of support. But some women, I'm thinking about Pamela Anderson, who recently just took pictures.
No makeup. Yeah.
This is me. And she was just radiating happiness, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that she did that, because even when I saw that, I was thinking, you know, and then people want to label it as brave when really she's just showing up as herself. And yeah, we're calling it brave to take off the mask. But I know in my own life, in terms of sensitivity, I think that if I were to really do a deep dive on it, why am I feeling sensitive about things? And it's because I'm spending too much energy in trying to make everybody feel comfortable in how I look and how I present myself, instead of, am I comfortable in how I'm presenting myself?
Yeah, taking care of yourself, getting to bed on time, reading. I love that. I love reading before bed is now basically like my meditation time. Like I have to have it like every night, and I'm into fantasy, like the smutty fantasy. So I love that you said that. But
yes,
mysteries are very fun too.
Yeah, mysteries are fun too. Hey, you know what? You got to have some of the smut in there. I mean, I think it's so funny. Women love these books. And I just think, oh, I'm all for it. I think it's great. Men have had, I think that women are more open about it. And there's been this assumption that women are not sexual or something like that, which is just not true and is proven by the erotic fiction industry. But women are just more thoughtful and they want to read and have a whole picture and a storyline. And men don't need as much.
Yeah, we need our real boyfriend and book boyfriends.
Yes.
And fantasy world, real world. Absolutely. Very helpful.
I know they say a friend, like when you die, a good friend will erase your Google search history. And I'm like, a real friend will burn my Kindle. So I'm not worried about my search history. I'm like, get rid of the Kindle.
That's really funny. That's good. That's really good. Mine are all like my physical books. So I'd be like, just burn the house down, take the dogs out, collect the insurance money. So as a philosopher, your relationship with your self-esteem, how has that developed?
It really comes from practice over time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say we have this idea where you're supposed to just pretend, the whole fake it type thing. But that's not really where self-esteem comes from. Self-esteem is the aftermath of the work and the accomplishments. So I am still sheepish when I write something. I still get nervous. I was just at an academic conference, and it doesn't matter how many I do, I was still nervous to stand up in front of my peers and to say something that I was thinking about. It still happens. But when you keep practicing and keep putting your ideas forth, which is what philosophers do, they critique other philosophers or ideas, or they present a new way of looking at something. And I think it's harder to present a new way of looking at something than it is to critique an existing thing. When you're presenting something new, especially to your peers who also all have PhDs, right? And that's your audience. And it's a little bit unnerving. But the self-esteem grows when you get the hang of it, when you get positive responses from it, when people come and talk to you about your paper afterwards. So I think the only way to develop self-esteem, really, and we need to teach this to our children, is get in the habit of that mindset of the practice, because the self-esteem comes from doing good work. It doesn't come before the good work. It comes from doing the good work. And it's an ongoing process.
And sometimes failing. And getting the data feedback and then trying again. It's growth mindset. Absolutely.
Absolutely. I was interviewing a woman earlier today, and we were talking about success in business, and she has a particular business, and her advice was, I don't think about failures, but you have to be comfortable with no. And when I was reflecting on that, I have some publications, and somebody might look at that and be like, oh, wow, that's amazing. But what they don't know is the behind the scenes stuff, that for nearly everything that was published, the first time I sent it out, it was rejected. And then when I got it back, I ended up going over the notes and polishing it up and then submitting it somewhere else, rejected again. getting it back. And it could happen five times. There was one paper that I published that took 3 years. It was just about 3,000 words, just an academic paper. It took 3 years. One of my friends had heard me present it at a conference and he encouraged me to publish it. My point is that when I look at the finished piece that actually did find its home in some journal, it is so much better than the first thing I sent out. Thank God it was rejected, because if it wasn't rejected, I wouldn't have sat down and worked it out and have been more thoughtful about my language, my quotes, how I was organizing things. So one way to build self-esteem is to appreciate the feedback, even if it's not what you want to hear. It's not all feedback is good. Some no's are not, they're off base. Some no's are off base. But if you just continually look at your work, and no matter what the field is, then those no's can actually be very helpful for you to move forward and to grow.
I love the even using that as an analogy. It's pretty beautiful of your iterations of your paper, and you're going through the drafts, you're getting feedback, you're changing it. You can do that for yourself too, as a person. If you want to grow and you want to change, you want to get better, it's just think of it as the iterations of who you are, and you're changing based on the feedback of the world, how you're being received, all of that. And it's a beautiful way to live. It's a scary way to live, but it would definitely help you, I think, propel if you were that tuned in to reception, and also not caring too much, going back to our earlier point. But like finding that balance. Love it. I threw something in here because I listened to your most recent episode as of yesterday of your Good is in the Details podcast. And there was some play around the idea of getting to know yourself. I forget the exact context now. I should have written that down, but I've always thought, and I thought that this would be fun for this conversation because we are trying to understand who we are as people, but I've always thought the idea of getting to know yourself was really weird. So growing up, people would say, oh, you'll understand more about yourself as an adult, and you'll understand your likes and your dislikes and what you're good at and what you're not good at. And the whole time I'm like, it is so weird finding myself rather than directing myself. And when I'm learning new hobbies and pursuing new things, even like at work, I like to think I'm in the driver's seat and I'm telling myself what I like, and I'm telling myself now what I'm going to do. And it's just such a weird dynamic. And I'm wondering, like, what did it be? Should I be searching more within for what I would be very good at, or should I direct it more? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, this is actually a really heated discussion with zero answer in either philosophy or psychology. And that question is, what is a self? Because all the things that you said are actually very difficult to pin down. Because intuitively, we understand that if you look at a baby picture of yourself, you say, that's me. But there is nothing resembling you and the you are today from that. So what constitutes a self? And is it our memories? If somebody was in an accident and they lost all of their memories, they would still be them, but they wouldn't have the memories. So the memories can't be the only thing, but it can't be on a cellular level because that changes. So the question of the self is actually a really interesting philosophical question of who is in the driver's seat. I will say that it is something that's in a process. And the philosopher you were talking about, Aaron Simmons, wrote a book called Camping with Kierkegaard, and he did a lot of academic work. And then he decided to write down this piece that was talking about enjoying the now. And his background in existentialist philosophy was a guide for, wait a minute, how do you take the time to be with your family? How is it that you take the time to be in nature? If you're constantly thinking about goals, then you're going to lose a sense of the present. Yeah. And I found that to be really helpful. And I would say, you know, with what is the self, it's a little bit like there is the core, but it also has to be open, because in situations that we don't even know, you also discover more about who you are. I want to say, I'm like I mentioned, my daughter is four. I'm older. So being pregnant was a very big surprise, because that wasn't really on the table for me, or I'd been told that it was unlikely that I would ever be pregnant. So when I had just been living my life as I was living my life, I was quite surprised to find myself as a mother, because this is adding to the definition of me. And it had not even been part of my consciousness. I didn't even project it as a future me in any way. But I am learning about myself. This is an example that pre-daughter, how I would measure a good day. And so I've always been very in academia, I've always been very focused on how much am I reading, what am I teaching, how much am I writing. So I just have a big to-do list of what is accomplished. After having her, the measurement of a good day is radically different. The measurement of a good day, especially during COVID, it was like, I'm alive, she's alive.
She was like a baby, right? A year old.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a baby. I was a brand new mom in my 40s during COVID. So everything was new. And I was starting a podcast at the exact same time. All of this hit. Just as Rudy and I decided to launch the podcast, about a month later, I was so tired and I couldn't figure out why. And I was pregnant. And then my daughter was born in January, late January of 2020. And then in March, everything shut down. And it's just amazing how everything ended up working out. I don't want to make light of the fact because COVID was such a serious time and so devastating for so many people. So I don't want to make it too light. For me as a brand new mom, it worked out in that I didn't need to return to the classroom. Everything was on Zoom. So that angst of being separated from my daughter wasn't there. But the measurement of a good day is no longer about a to-do list. The measurement of a good day, I've noticed, is my relationships. Who have I laughed with? Who did I talk with? Did I go for a good walk? Did I read a good book? Did I hear a good idea? My daughter, did we get a chance to play? That's one of the measurements of a good day for me is, did I make time to play with my daughter? And that's not a goal. That's not for future self. That is for present self. Now, to answer your question, what I mean by this is that I'm discovering that about myself, and I could have never predicted that 10 years ago. It is part of me. It's an addition to me, but you learn more about what you're made of through challenges that are either external or that you bring on yourself. I don't think you ever know yourself 100% because there's the you that's going to be in a situation or an encounter, an opportunity, or a serious challenge. And then you are like, oh, that core part of me that I didn't know was maybe wasn't totally aware of leapt out. And I took care of people. I would imagine people in when we hear about really awful situations, let's say a school shooting or something like that. And then there is that teacher or that person who covered their students and saved them. They probably didn't know that was them until that situation arose. And now they are redefining their character. They are understood as courageous, right? So I think that when it comes to understanding the self, the more you challenge yourself and put yourself in different situations, we're supposed to be in flux. I would imagine, hopefully, in a positive direction. But that is something, that's why I also say invite aging, invite it. When I think about the me pre-daughter versus now, there's nothing I would trade. I'm like, thank goodness. And because I've enjoyed so much of my life, I know that I have so much more to do. There's more cities to visit. There's more podcasts to do. There's more ideas. There's the joy of my daughter growing up. So invite that because it's going to continually enhance who you are.
I like that a lot because I like that more than how I was thinking about it because of your examples of you're leaping out of yourself, you're doing something you never thought you could. And it's really valuable during times of fear, where and it's such a good point, if I was directing myself when I'm afraid, I would run. But if something inside of me needs to protect another person, needs to protect myself in a way that I can't run, like a wild animal on a hike, and you have to go somewhere else, then that's such a good point because I didn't think I had that in me. It's something you hear all the time. But it's just people do it because they have to.
And the next book you read that's not smut, the next book that you read,
I don't know what that'll be.
Let's say you read a nonfiction or a history book or something like that, or you listen to another podcast, then you're going to learn something new and that's going to be added to who you are. And then that means that you are going to be reflecting and thinking on something that you wouldn't have the day before. So there's this constant reassessment of what it means to be a self.
Wow.
I think being static would be the scariest thing. being static. Because if you're static, then you're no different than an object like the phone. This is never going to be any different. Or from an animal, where you've got your dogs. I've got a cat. My cat is never going to wake up one day and, you know what? I'm not going to be an asshole. My cat is never going to decide that. She will always be that way because that is innate. But a human being, because we have this beautiful capacity to reason, we have this capacity for language, for communication, for these levels of love, that means that we are constantly able to grow and to be in flux. So be grateful for that capacity, because the antithesis of that would be to be an object that is static.
Yeah, or an object that goes completely on instinct, like those dogs that just went crazy. Your asshole cat. Very, very good examples. Okay, then we can take it back a little bit to our childhood. We've been dipping into it, but in terms of when self-esteem and when imposter syndrome are introduced into our lives, when is that? Are they born intrinsically? Are these things that we are completely learning? Is it a mixture?
I don't know. I do know that it is around puberty where there is a big difference between boys and girls in school. But before puberty, there really isn't any difference in ambition. It changes at puberty. So they've done studies where it's like they ask boys and girls, do you want to be president of the United States? Pre-puberty, the numbers are exactly the same from boys and girls. They're the same. After puberty, it changes. It dips off. So that is a biological marker. But then you've also got a cultural thing. I don't know what happens. Maybe part of it could be because of that biological marker, and that girls are maturing faster physiologically than boys, that there is still a lot of shame that's around menstruation. And so maybe, I don't know if that plays a psychological role in it, just this fear of what's happening to my body. And then adding that to just trying to go to school and be a kid and fit in, all of a sudden, there is just this strange thing going on with the body, and there's this level of self-consciousness. How do you cover it up? Everything is about covering up the fact that you are having this process that is completely normal. So if it is just some sort of a scientific thing, or if it's a cultural thing, I'm not sure, but I do know that it happens around puberty. And I do know that social media is not helping at all, especially with children being on it so much, and they're constantly comparing themselves to their peers and or to influencers. And that is really difficult. And young women just have it so different than men. Like I said, men do have it as well, but it's not to the point of women. Like, I'll give you an example. I posted something on TikTok. I don't know. What it was, something about women. I think it was about inviting age. It was something along those lines. And how a woman over a certain age is no longer a value. And some guy commented, you know, it's like when men want a car, they want a younger or newer model with no mileage. And that's just how it is. And I'm thinking, okay, this is the problem. You have just compared a woman to an inanimate object for purchase. That's what you've done. And that mentality, then it's not just a man's issue. Women adopt that too, where they invest a lot of money into their appearance instead of what would give you real power. Buy real estate, buy some stocks, your retirement account, have your own account, when you could have real power, real financial power and freedom if your money was shifted in that direction. But instead, the illusion of power through beauty and a bunch of cosmetic procedures is women buying into that idea that they are something of value to be purchased for men. And a lot of women are opting out of this. A lot of women are saying, you know what, this is just not the lifestyle I want to lead. And then that also causes a lot of conversation. This question of, oh, you're just going to be alone with cats. And I respond to that with, that's not my situation, but I respond to that sort of sentiment of, first of all, cats are great. And second of all, women do outlive men. So this threat of you're going to die alone is not really there. Women outlive men. And it turns out that men, when they are either widowed or divorced, they need to remarry within the next 3 years, or statistically, they will die. They are less likely to live. And it is because women care for their husbands. They take care of their medication. They make them go to the doctor. They take care of everything for them. But women do outlive men. And so this attack on women is that you have to be a perfect object for us to have. And women do buy into that somehow makes them better or more moral. That is a course correction that is needed. Again, I don't want to be on a soapbox. I'm not outside of this. Like, I get my Botox, okay? I get my nails done. I like to have my hair colored. So I am not totally outside of this. But I do know that if you want to have real financial power and freedom, your money needs to go toward that. It's never going to come from if you have the perfect nose or the perfect boobs. That's not going to get it for you.
And it's not like men when they get that perfect woman, they're actually going to be like, I've made it. I know I need nothing else. One of my favorite examples is Beyonce was still cheated on by Jay-Z. Okay. And she is the epitome of probably a perfect woman in America. But he was unfaithful and yeah, took him back and all of that. Now they're fine, I think. But that is just, it doesn't matter. So she should just make more Lemonade albums and make more money and say, I'm going to be okay with or without you. Doesn't even matter. Your opinion doesn't matter.
It's so pervasive because, like I said, there is this almost moral implication that a woman is somehow a better person when she takes care of herself. And then when you look at what that takes care of herself is, a lot of it is superficial as opposed to what I was talking about before. I've even told my partner this because sometimes he's like, hey, why aren't we spending time? Or I don't know, like he wants more time or something like that, which I'm very happy to do. And also with my daughter, sometimes I'm like, here. Your turn. And I one time had a very serious conversation with him, and I said, look, I have to show up for myself so that I can show up for you. And what that looks like is, yeah, going and getting a book and being alone and reading. So that means, yeah, sometimes on a Friday night, no, I don't want to go out. I don't want to find the babysitter and I don't want to go out. I want to be in my sweats and I want to read a book so that we can go out tomorrow night. And then I think he got it. But if I were to say, no way, I want to show up for myself. I've got an appointment to have surgery. That's just not quite. That's not quite the same thing. I don't want to be too hard on women who do go for surgical procedures, but I just want to make sure that we're being very clear about what the goal is or what you think it means to enjoy your life.
Absolutely. I'm not above it either. Botox, some filler. I love it. I'm 35 and I want to look like I'm 25. It's just, but it has nothing to do with how other people perceive me. It's how I want to feel. And I love how it makes me feel and the skincare too.
We had a plastic surgeon on the podcast. It was like in the very early iterations of Good Is in the Details, and she specializes in the nose. And so I was very interested in asking her, what is beauty? This is her industry. So what is beauty and what is health? Because if you're studying medicine, then what's going on? So we wanted to talk about that. But something she said that really softened me or made a really big impression. And she gave an example of there was a woman who was about to get married and she wanted to have cosmetic procedures done. This woman had scars on her body and on her face, and she wanted to straighten her nose a little bit. It had been broken and it was crooked. She wanted this before her wedding day. All of that scarring and the broken came from an abusive relationship. And so this woman wanted a clean slate. There was no medical reason for her to have the scars changed or her nose. There was zero medical urgency there. But it really was, when we're talking about what is health, it was for this woman to show up on her wedding day and to start a new chapter for life and let go of that other stuff. And then there was another example of somebody who had been a young girl who had been teased relentlessly about her nose. And the doctor, she gave her rhinoplasty. And she said, it's not that it's going to make you a brand new great person. It's just that she just wants to walk into a room and not her nose be the only thing that people are noticing. So I want to be very cautious about, if I don't want to sound like I'm too hard on plastic surgery, but that there is definitely an understanding and there can be an investment in it when it comes from how is it that you want to show up in the world, but are you showing up for the male gaze or are you showing up for your own happiness? That's something that you might want to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Love it. So what about faking confidence then? So you can buy confidence in a lot of ways. But in those places where people are saying, fake it till you make it, what are your thoughts on that coming from the philosophy lens?
I know that there is something to enhancing your posture when you go into a room, and there is something about the mind-body connection that will make you feel better. But if I don't think that it is a strength to pretend that you know something that you don't know. And that comes from my roots in philosophy. The great Socrates was very famous for saying that he was the wisest man in Athens because he never pretended to know what he didn't know. And that's what made him wise. And there's two things about that: real wisdom, real greatness comes from the humility to be able to admit what you don't know. But with that also comes the curiosity to be like, oh, I don't know that. I'm going to go learn that. And those two things go hand in hand. And that is somebody that you can really respect. So faking knowledge of something is maybe could give you a very temporary sense of respect around people, but it is so inauthentic that it's just not going to last. I think if you don't know something, then that is an opportunity to figure out what it is and figure it out quickly. But I want for people to have, like good posture and feel good about themselves and feel confident in what they do know. And if there's something that you don't know, then it is okay to go ahead and inquire. That's the opportunity. That's what it means to be wise, is to recognize what you don't know. And as far as faking it, it's a tough one. It's like you want to be honest, but at the same time, you don't want to tell everybody how miserable you are. So sometimes it might feel like you're faking it a little bit. I think be modest about your success, or be honest about the trials. I think that gets so much more, that just gives deeper levels of connection.
I agree.
And not just in friendships, but even in potential businesses, when you're like, oh, let's help each other out. Let's do this. I see you've got something that's very cool. I've got something. You don't have to pretend as though you have the most successful business and somebody would be honored to work with you. You can just go ahead and say, hey, I've been wanting to raise my numbers. I think we would make a really great team working together. That's what I don't know. That's what I would go about. But I'm not for faking it, because as a professor, I can, and as somebody who has read a lot, when somebody opens their mouth and they're talking about something they don't know, I can tell right away. I don't call people out on it. I just do the nod. But I can tell when somebody doesn't know something. It's really obvious, and I'll let them have it, but I have lost respect for them. It's gone, and they will never have it. So why risk that?
In the same vein of understanding when to gain knowledge, gaining knowledge in general. I read a really interesting Medium article, and it basically was saying that imposter syndrome may not always come from low self-esteem. It can actually be an incorrect assessment of one's abilities. I liked that because it could be a good check. If we believe we don't know what we are doing, we can learn more, study more, gain more knowledge. What steps can we take then to understand if our feelings of imposter syndrome is due to an actual lack of knowledge? So we might have to feel like we have to fake it till we make it because we are overwhelmed and we don't have the knowledge, or if we are actually better at something than we think we are.
The philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote a book on happiness, and he answers this by saying, check in with, there are cues around you. There are people who will let you know, there are checks around it. So if you think that you're really excelling in something, but you've never had any positive feedback, or nobody wants to hire for doing the thing that you say you're the best at, then it's time to keep it in check. And it works the other way, of course. If you don't think that your skills are right there, but other people are telling you, or other people are buying your product, or they want to engage with you, then it's time to do a check. So one thing that you can do is take an assessment of how, not weighing everything on public perception, but take an assessment of how the world is responding to your talents, so that you can see where to work on and get more of an honest assessment, because other people will be honest, more honest than you.
So I get gather feedback.
Gather feedback. Absolutely. Get
Get
feedback.
the
If you want to talk about imposter syndrome and just lying and fake it, look at presidential candidates. Everybody goes in as we're going to win. We're going to win.
Yeah.
And there's only one person who does, but they
Yeah.
all go in and they all suck. They all say, when I am president of the United States, and we're watching that and we know it's silly because you're trying to talk yourself into it and have a mindset. And it is a little bit silly because then, just for example, within politics, it shifts from the idea of you're trying to take a position where you are caring and protecting an entire population and you are essentially a public servant, and instead turning it around to talk about how wonderful you are, then it's silly. So you can see that. When you see presidential, and I'm not blaming any particular political party, this is across the board, but
Yeah.
you definitely see that.
And they feel so confident. They radiate confidence. And you're like, oh no, they're really going to do that.
Yeah.
They really mean it, even though what they're saying might actually be impossible.
Yes,
But
yes.
they will try to convince it. It's not. Okay. We are coming towards the end. And I wanted to make sure that you felt like everything that you wanted to say on the topic was on the table, because I've probably missed something. I am far from philosophy.
Oh, I think, I don't know if there's any much more. I like your questions. I like the way that this is all organized. I think that there is a self-esteem issue with young girls. And so what I would say, and I think it's with young men too. I know we're focusing on women, but one of the issues I'm going to say is with social media, scrolling, and then even when it comes to dating, people are awkward. They're not even going up and approaching each other, or they consider that self so that's so creepy. So they're just doing the DM thing and liking all the stuff on Instagram, to the point where people don't even know how to communicate and read social cues. And I've had people ask, what do you do? Because you can't just say, get off the phone. That's not going to work. And so this is something I've encouraged, is that lead by example. So I've told people of the elder Gen X generation, boomer generation, to talk to your grandkids and describe how you fell in love with your partner. Describe how you met. Tell them about all of the fun times, about the awkward interactions and things like that. So instead of just saying, hey, stop being on the phone, because that also lowers self-esteem, right? Like, we're lessening our connections, we're lowering our self-esteem with all of that. I think one of the ways is to just lead by example. Tell your love story. If you are a boomer, say about how you got your partner, who put you together, where would you go out on dates? How would you connect? Have these beautiful friendships and in front of children or grandchildren so they can hear the stories and laugh and how crazy you were and things like that. So that there is that sense that there is another possibility of how to be. And I think also just encourage talent. When you see talent in somebody else, this can be a peer, a friend, or somebody younger. Let them know. Let them be like, I see you. Like, this is very cool what you're doing. Don't do any envy or jealousy. Forget about yourself for a second. Be generous and be like, hey, I think you're really good at such and such. Or could you teach me this? Or wow, I wish I had your talent at such and such. Let's be kinder to each other. And that helps with, I think, with self-esteem and just respecting that other people might be suffering and they might be self-conscious. And when you see somebody who's amazing, you let them know, hey, you're fantastic.
Very beautiful. I love that. And human connection, just pull it out where you can and put it in front of other people. Love
Yeah.
it, especially the younger kids. Gwendolyn, where can people find you for more of your wisdom? I know we have, I'll link the Good is in the Details podcast, but what else would you like them to know?
I'm on Instagram. We've got the
Cool.
Good is in the Details pod on Instagram. And then my personal one is Prof Dolsky. So it's Prof Dolsky. And yeah, I love to connect with people that way. So somebody checks out Good is in the Details. I love to know what they think. It's an absolute joy to put together. So thank you very much.
It's a very good listen on a walk. I loved it. And I was telling you, Gwendolyn, the feedback for her so far was
it makes me so
such
happy.
good content, like such good content that I
really
don't normally
appreciate that.
Get like an idea of a question from podcasts because I'm just thinking so much. And I was like, I need to write this down. But no, it was perfect thought, just like continuous, but not overwhelming. I loved it.
Thank you. That really means a lot. Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on here and taking your time to share with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to the You're Not Qualified podcast, you capable babes. I'm very excited that you made it to the end of this episode. I would love to hear from you. If you feel inspired by the stories that you hear on this podcast, if you feel inspired by this particular one, please drop me a line. I can be reached by email, ynqpod@gmail.com. I am most active on Instagram. The handle is @ynqpod. Please drop me a DM there. I love chatting with you all. Write a comment, anything you'd like. I just want to hear what you think. If you think that you'd be a great fit for this podcast and you want to come on and tell your story of how you overcame imposter syndrome, please get in touch. Or if you know of somebody that you think would also love to tell their story, get them in touch with me. Would love to hear from them. If you like what you hear, I love it when you subscribe. So please do so or follow me, depending on what platform you're listening on. And also leave a review. Spotify does this really fun thing now where you can actually leave a review after a prompt. It's a really exciting way to get engaged. I realized it not too long ago when scrolling through Spotify that they let you put prompts as the creator. And I would love to hear from you. So please just get in touch. Let's get involved. I am so excited that you are even listening, and I really, really, really hope that this inspires you to get out and do that damn thing. Go do everything that scares you. You are way more capable than you think you are. I promise you. Again, friends, thank you so much for listening. Go do that thing. I will see you very soon. Bye.